tune out of the anti-white system
and tune into the pro-white system on RadioAryan.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to our continuing series on Henry Ford's The International Jew. I am your host, Ted Midward. Thanks for tuning in to RadioAryan.com. First and foremost, let me say Merry Christmas to all the listeners here at RadioAryan.com. I hope you have a tremendous Christmas with friends, family, loved ones. Hope you guys are safe on your travels. And I hope you guys have a great time. And most of all, amidst all the fun, games, and gifts, take a second to remember that this is supposed to be a remembrance of the birth of our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. Praise Christ. Praise Yahweh. Okay, let's get on with this segment. The first half of the program is entitled The Present Status of the Jewish Question. The Jewish question in the United States has existed for years, but until now in silence and suspicion. Everyone knew that there was such a question. The Jew himself knew best of all, but very few possessed the courage to open the question to the sanitary influences of sunlight and speech. The mention of courage in this connection is needful to explain the silence. A few men of insight have attempted publicly to define the question in the United States, and they have been so effectually dealt with by an invisible power of which the public could have no knowledge that free speech on the Jewish question naturally became unpopular. The fact, it is true, reflects far more seriously on non-Jews than on Jews. But it is a fact nevertheless. He who undertakes to speak truth on this question must expect far more opposition than he could ever withstand were he not speaking the truth. One fact that militated against free speech on the Jewish question was the condition into which our American people have been trained, of expecting applause and approval to follow every act and word. There was a time in American history, and it was the most glorious period of our past, when opposition was considered an often desirable attitude. A man's weight was accounted equal, whether computed by the number of his enemies or his friends. But a softening change has overcome us. We have grown to like applause. Hisses used to stir our fathers. Hisses now cow their sons. Public speech has thus grown flabby. The press has thus become neutral. We have grown pudgy and futile in our program of helping the weak, so pudgy and futile that we no longer have gristle to attack the strong who have brought weakness upon the others. As a people, we have passed the bunk around so habitually. We have enervated our judgment and moral convictions so seriously by our fake philosophy of boost. We have become so accustomed to measure the effectiveness of work by the applause it immediately provokes, that we've lost all stomach for courses that call for contest, unless it be those spurious contests of the political arena, which are all managed from the same great headquarters, or those verbal assaults against big business, which bring no reaction. We have lost all taste for tangible foes who have a ready retaliation. Folks, this is 100 years ago he's saying this. This is most certainly true today. Most certainly true. I know you all have seen it. I know you all have witnessed it, and I know you all have experienced being left all by your lonesome, all by yourself, when you dare speak the truth. You know it, and I know it. Continuing on. Nevertheless, it is true. that whereas a year ago it was not possible to speak the word Jew in the United States, it is now possible. The name appears on the front page of every newspaper nearly every day. It is the subject of discussion everywhere. For the time at least, speech has been liberated, although our friends of the B'nai B'rith in every state are doing their best to throttle it. This freedom is of benefit both to Jew and non-Jew. The Jew need no longer look askance at the name of his race on the lips of the non-Jew. It only means that suppression and deceit are past. That is all. The Jew is a Jew, is recognized as a Jew, is spoken of as a Jew, and thus an honest relation between the mind and the fact is established in both the Jew and the non-Jew. The air is cleared. Concealment, on the one hand, is done away. On the other hand, a missing fact, whose absence meant confusion, is supplied. The Jew may now say, "I am a Jew," as casually as any other man might claim his race. We may even see some noted Americans who all their lives have tried to conceal their race come forward now and say, "We are Jews." It is freedom to the Jew. It is interpretation to the non-Jew. Half the confusion which men meet in their efforts to account for the world is due to their ignorance of just where the Jew is. He is always a key, but if the key be disguised as something else, how can it be used? 8 months ago, the Dearborn Independent began a series of studies on the Jewish question. It was an attempt to state the facts on which the question is based. It was not, at its beginning, nor has it since developed into, an attack on Jews as Jews. Its purpose was enlightenment, and if it secretly indulged a hope, it was this, that the leaders of American Jewry might be wise to see that this is the country and this is the time in which the causes of distress and distrust and disrepute might be removed from Jewry in a genuine modus operandi, not of toleration, but of reconciliation, be arrived at. The proof that these articles have contained facts and only facts is found in the failure of the Jewish spokesman to show any one of them to be false. The record stands that way. Not one disproof. The reason for the record is this. When only facts are sought and subjected to the tests, only facts are found. If, however, one embarks on a campaign whose purpose is to besmirch an opponent or create a prejudice, one's partisan zeal may induce him to accept as facts what is merely probability. These articles, however, do not constitute a campaign. They are the lighting of lamps here and there about the country, in this industry and that, in the corners heretofore kept dark by those who should serve more faithfully on the watchtower of the press. What the Dearborn Independent has said could have had no weight at all, had not the people been able to see the same facts all about them. It is not information, but illumination, that has given these articles the importance they have found among hundreds of thousands of readers. The Jewish response to these articles has in one way been gratifying, and in another way, quite disappointing. The Jewish response has been gratifying in that it has furnished substantial proof of all the statements made in the Dearborn Independent. This journal has no doubt of the truth of its statements, and is possessed of a very substantial reserve of evidence, but nonetheless, the corroborative evidence produced by the Jewish leaders themselves in endeavoring to meet the issue is appreciated. There is no reason to believe that this was an intentional contribution on the part of Jewish leaders. It was simply impossible for them to move without revealing further evidence. It is quite well known, what is the position of Jewish leaders today. It's one of fear, for once they themselves are possessed with the fear of the unknown. Knowing how much of truth exists behind the statements made in the series, they are in fear of what may yet come forth. They do not even make any more pretense of considering it a joke. In their own conclaves, they do not rave and roar like the rabbinical editors. They behave themselves like sober, frightened men, who sometimes have a desire to own up to some of the things that have been charged, but who are halted by a doubt as to how far the owning up process would lead them if once begun. They are in fear of the truth, but mostly of the whole truth. Needless to say, a responsibility rests also on those who hold the whole truth. The purpose determines everything. If the purpose is to breed hatred of the Jews, that involves one course of action. If the purpose is to excite the public mind with startling facts, that involves another course of action. There is a certain danger in certain kinds of information. If the purpose is to lay a basis for intelligent, straightforward understanding and a possible solution of the question, then such information as defines the question and presents all essential material is all that's necessary. It is within these limits that this series has endeavored to keep. If there are facts which are unfavorable to the Jews, that is a matter for the Jews. If the Jews do despite to a certain class of facts, it may be necessary to produce still another class of facts. If the leaders of the Jews had been fair, just argumentatively, oppositionally fair, they would not now be in fear of what may yet be produced. Jews, for illustration, have proved the statement that they are the best organized people in the United States. They have proved that they are more closely grouped together in their own national interest than are the citizens of the United States, whose whole nationality is defined by their citizenship. The government of the United States itself is not so well organized as American Jewry. And that fact is not due to anything American. It is the same in every country. Telegraphic speed and instantaneous mass action have marked every move organized Jewry has made in this country in the last 6 months. It's not for nothing that they control the avenues of communication in this country. It's not for nothing that the wireless of the world is under ironclad Jewish control. They are not loosely organized in social lodges for occasional fellowship. They are organized as states of the Jewish people, with officials who do nothing whatever but attend to the advancement of Jewish power in this and other countries. They have proved, by the mass play of their synagogues, their newspapers, their alleged social organizations, their conservative clubs, and their Bolshevik socialist groups, all of them working together under orders, that they are a separate people within the American people, a people that do not agree with the genius of the American people, and a people that constantly make distinction between Jewish and American rights. In every state, in every city, there's a Jewish organization with a definite policy, and the first policy is to suffocate, destroy, put the fear of the Jew upon any man, newspaper, or institution that gives the least indication of independent thought on the Jewish question. These organizations have special committees to do certain work. One of these works is to start a whispering drive against the person or institution that they aim at. This whispering drive is a most hideous Oriental device. It can be sustained only by groups of minds which bear a certain racial twist. Without giving a full description of the devices used, it can be seen that the fact of their being centrally controlled and working simultaneously in all parts of the country creates a considerable force. No other institution now operating in the U.S. can accomplish that so quickly and unitedly. Jewish solidarity would be above criticism were it used for the benefit of the whole communal life, but it isn't. It is not only Jewish, but its operations show it to be largely anti-American. This does not mean anti-American in the sense of being pro-German or pro-Mexican, but in the sense that it opposes many things that have been conceded to constitute the American tradition. The Jew assumes that the United States is still an unformed entity, which is fair prey to any who can seize it and mold it. That's his attitude, the Jew, today. He refuses to assume that America is here. He adopts the belief that part of his duty is to bring America into being, on Jewish lines, of course. You know what? That's absolutely true. The Jews take something and they remold it in their image. As Satan does. Takes God's creation and he twists it, he warps it, he adulterates it, makes it impure. The Jews do the same thing, to where almost 100 years after this publication, 90% of the white people think America exists as some kind of international halfway house, some sort of international refuge for the world's garbage to be dumped here, and that we're supposed to take them in, that America's a nation of immigrants, and white Christian people had nothing to do with its formation, that's just an ugly lie, and blah, blah, blah. Here we are. He was absolutely right. Henry and his editors were absolutely right. Continuing on. Now, in a sense, the United States is private property. It's the property of those who share the ideals of the founders of the government. And those ideals were ideals held by a white race of Europeans. They were fundamentally Christian ideals. And with most of these, the Jews not only disagree, but hold them in utter contempt. Indeed, a Jewish leader recently said in New York that the United States was not a Christian land, and the context of his statement showed that he clearly intended that it should never be. He was condemning the Christian Sunday, though he is an officer of a society whose purpose is the establishment of the Mosaic Sabbath. The Jews have also proved the charge that they exercise disproportionate influence in governmental affairs. This charge has only been stated in this series. The mass of proof has not yet been brought to bear, but it exists, fixed beyond all change. However, another important bit of evidence has been transpiring before the country's eyes. When the immigration bill was first put up to Congress, the vote was overwhelmingly in favor of restricting entry into the country. Congress voted upon the facts and its patriotic convictions. Taking the question just as it was, no other verdict could have been given. Hardly had the vote been taken, however, than the wires were hot and the trains crowded and Jewish protests and Jewish agents began flocking to Washington, D.C. The magic name Jew was uttered. Legislators fled to cover. Learned speeches were made. Compromises were suggested. Modifications of the original law were framed. Under the magic of Jew, the whole proposal simply melted like an icicle before a fire. The only protest made against the congressional vote was made by Jews. Their wonderful teamwork in all parts of the country gave their protest the air of national importance. But there was one point the Jews were not able to, this year, deny. And that is that the majority of immigrants are Jews. That fact, fortunately, was established beforehand. The hand of the Congress of the United States was stayed by the Jews in a matter of serious importance to national protection. Just a few years ago, the hand of the Congress of the United States was forced to break the treaty with Russia when President Taft held it would be wrong to break it. This proof of political power, based on nothing but sheer force and sheer determination to have what they want regardless of what the U.S. wants, has appeared broadcast as a matter of public knowledge. And let the reader or the listener mark this. It will be found that this present immigration move is as much a part of the world Jewish program as was the breaking of the treaty with Russia. Readers of the article of January 15th will recall how, at the behest of the Jews, the United States trade with Russia was thrown into the hands of German Jews who were using it to further their plans for the destruction of the Russian Empire, which of course later came to pass. the Jews used the United States to put across an essential part of that plan. Well, what are they using the United States for now? We may well believe that the Jews are not without several reasons for what they're doing. The Jew excels as a chess player because he plays a game wherever he may be. The immigration matter amounts to this. Jews are streaming out of Poland as speedily as they can. It is not pogroms that are driving them out. Pogroms have been proved to be immigration propaganda for consumption outside Poland. There is a claim that's made, the Jews are leaving Poland because they know something is going to happen. And if they're leaving Poland, it is a sign that it is going to happen to Poland. And if the Jews have advanced news of it, it is a sign that what will occur will be inflicted by Jews. Plainly stated, it's this. Jewish Bolshevism in Russia has made a secret decree against Poland. The Jews are getting out of the way. American Jewish agents are constantly passing into Poland. Rich American Jews are sending agents to bring back groups of relatives. There's an exodus from Poland, and there is a reason for it, which spells trouble for Poland. The United States is being used as the chief means by which the Jews are to clear out. France protests against them and will not have them. England most decidedly refuses to have them. The Jews of the United States are powerful enough to compel this country to take them. We are utilized to effect the entrance of Bolshevism into Russia. It went from our east side thither. We are now being utilized to assist the destruction of Poland. It is possible, however, that by the time the Jewish program reaches that point, something may have intervened. The Jews of the United States have also given a splendid illustration of what the Dearborn Independents said of their control of American newspapers. Of course, the local newspaper editor is not dominated by any Jewish authority seated at Washington, New York, or Chicago. Of course not. But he is very amenable to the 20 richest Jews in his community who advertise in his newspaper, and it is they who take orders from Washington, New York, and Chicago. So the editor gets his orders from Jewish headquarters just the same, though he may not realize it. This, however, is one instance where publicity does not count, because it represents a business favor oftener than it does an editorial conviction. The knowledge of the Jewish question, which newspapermen possess, is quite complete, and a confidential council of the best-informed editors of the U.S. would include all that the government or the people would need to know for a complete handling of the Jewish question. The publicity demanded and received by the organized Jews has proved a roarback. It has served the cause of truth more than the cause they desired, which was suppression. Gratifying as these proofs are to the producers of the facts, there is a very decided element of disappointment in the Jewish answers. Either Jewry is fainting or is defenseless. Certainly, the present status of the defense must be humiliating to those who have any conception of the importance of the matter. The answer signed by the Jews themselves, a list of signatures which showed, as in Panorama, the close-locked corporational solidarity of the Jewish race in this country, was devoid of a single fact which threw light. In this, the Jewish answer was almost a confession of no defense. But aside from its ineptitude was the utter lack of frankness. It refuses to face the question. It will not meet a single statement, either in the substance of the protocols or in the substance of this series. It veers off whenever it approaches a concrete theme and loses itself in a vapor of denials. If a statement is wrong, it is provably wrong. especially a statement which deals with matters now actual in daily life. The official Jewish answer, signed by a few, not all, of the Jewish leaders, is at least decent in its language, and that is more than can be said for most of the other Jewish answers. But it is indecent in its attempt to create the impression that anti-Semitism is abroad in the country. Take note of this. All the anti-Semitism that exists in the U.S. today is the deliberate creation of the Jewish leaders and is a recent creation. The Jewish leaders want anti-Semitism here. Unable to create it among non-Jews, they're seeking the effects of it among the Jews by telling them that it exists. The Jewish leaders of the United States have done everything possible to keep the Dearborn Independent away from the Jews, to prevent their reading it and learning the fact that no attack is being made on the Jews as Jews. From the first, after wrestling for weeks to discover a way of meeting these articles without having to confess too much, these leaders threw up their hands and took refuge in the lie of anti-Semitism. What they ought to fear now is not the force of an anti-Semitic feeling among the non-Jews, but the force of a righteous indignation among American Jews when they discovered the deceit and incompetence of their leaders. Anti-Semitism has always been the last resort of scoundrelly Jewish leaders when cornered by the truth, and they have been known deliberately to incite it among the Gentile rabble in order through it to maintain their hold on their own people. Are you listening out there? You know what? Henry and his researchers are absolutely correct here. And Theodore Herzl made statements and wrote such things that anti-Semites will be our best friends. And you gotta ask yourself, how do they get... It really is amazing when you think about it. How do they get some of these Jewish people to go over to Israel and live a life that really they can live as kings here in the United States, in New York City or L.A., and they can live on the fat of the goyim here and rape, rob, pillage, loot, you name it. The way they do it is that they take Jewish kids when they're young and they train them that the goyim are out to get them, tell them about the supposed Holocaust, tell them about Hitler, tell them about all the persecution that they face. And they literally scare the hell out of these people and to get away from the dangerous goyim who are going to exterminate them at any minute, they seek refuge in the state of Israel. And that's essentially how they do it. The rabbis, the teachers, they all brainwash young Jewish kids that the goyim are trouble. They're going to get us if we don't all go to Israel and give Israel all the power we can. And they really do abuse these kids. They really do. It's an absolute fact. Let me continue on with the text here. Recently, there was printed in the newspapers a protest against anti-Semitism, signed by various non-Jews. The protest was printed twice, in fact, because it did not go big the first time. The newspapers were evidently growing a little weary of printing daily communiques from Jewish great headquarters. So, to give it more vim for a thorough circulation, the signature of Woodrow Wilson was obtained, and of course, that put it on the telegraph wires again. It was quite proper for President Wilson to sign a protest against anti-Semitism. It was quite proper for all the other signers to do so, provided that was what they meant to do. If the protest had been sent to the Dearborn Independent, its responsible officials would have signed also. The Dearborn Independent is against anti-Semitism and protests against leading Jews using its name to foment that spirit. The protest, however innocent the signers may have been of this fact, was against any public discussion of the Jewish question, and especially against this one. The dispatches are careful to state that the Jews had nothing to do with that protest. a supposedly non-Jewish organization has been in the service of a coterie of New York Jews for a long time. The assertion that the protest was written by a single citizen, a non-Jew, acting upon his own initiative and responsibility, and without consultation with anybody, is plainly mildly amusing. Let me stop. Let me go back. I know you guys probably want more commentary on these, and I feel it's appropriate given what we're speaking about. There is something to this. I know probably some of the younger, more alt-right people who kind of just plainly put it out there and say what they want and say what they want about Jews may not catch this and may think this is weak or this is cucking or this is this or that, right? The issue of anti-Semitism. If you wanted to red pill someone about black crime in America, would you go up to them and be all huffy puffy mad and be all angry and start off ranting and raving about niggers this and niggers that and they're animals and they're this and they ain't good for nothing and we ought to kill them all? Is that how you would approach it? Of course not. You would want to approach it in a level-headed, non-threatening way that would induce them to continue listening and hear you out. You might take them to YouTube and make them watch, or let them watch, a few Colin Flaherty videos about black crime so that they could see it and see what's been hidden from them about black-on-white crime in America. And Colin Flaherty has a very excellent, non-threatening way of delivering the truth and red-pilling white people about black-on-white crime or black-on-Asian crime, just general black crime in America. It's the same principle with the Jewish question. If you want to attract intelligent people, if you want to make a broad case, if you want to not scare goyim away and turn them off and make them cringe at what they're hearing. You know, most people, most normies out there, you say the word Jew and they think you committed some kind of hate speech crime by saying that. They think, they don't know that that's an actual, you know, a proper term, like calling someone a Christian or Hindu. They've been hypersensitized to be against prejudice and bigotry of any kind, especially against the Jews. White people are scared to death of being called racist. So, again, I'm trying to illustrate here what Henry and his editors are getting at here with anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism works in favor of the Jews because it keeps the little ones in line. It keeps them from going off the reservation. And the big Jews know this. And the big Jews use anti-Semitism to keep all the peasants on the reservation, the little Jews. That's pretty much the principle he's getting at here. Back to the text. There was just enough consultation to make the whole non-Jewish protest nothing more nor less than a previously approved document, and the citizen who did the job has known for a long time where it pays to please. As for Mr. John Spargo, whose name is beginning to appear prominently as a Gentile defender of the Jews, this much is known. He did not undertake the Jewish defense without several secret consultations with a group of New York Jews, who had to overcome several of Spargo's scruples before they could make much headway with him. Spargo's attitude was something like this: "Gentlemen, they've got it on you. It's not a matter that can be whitewashed." Spargo told a lot of truth in that New York room. The Jewish conferees knew it was the truth. If Spargo should speak 1/20th as much truth on the platform, his lecture engagements would dwindle in number. All the literature of the Anti-Defamation Society, all the speech of the retained defenders, is very welcome. Open the question up. If the Jews engage enough Gentile defenders, the time will come when Gentile logical faculties will bring about a real discussion of the question. The Jewish spokesman must, on pain of losing their position, limit themselves to denials, abuse, and threats. But the Gentile defenders are constitutionally unable to dwell in that state of mind for long. They will probe through to the truth, in which event real discussion may be expected. There's not a single Jewish publication, however vituperative and truthless, that we would forbid the males or exclude from a public library. There is not a single Jewish spokesman whom we would heckle or hinder on the public platform. There's not a single Jewish enterprise that we would recommend for boycott. We believe in free speech and unfettered conviction. By means of these, the people may yet hope to clean up the United States. I apologize, I'm having trouble reading today. The Jews do not believe in free speech. They do not believe in a free press. In every state in the Union, the B'nai B'rith is introducing into local legislatures a bill that will prevent any publication from saying anything derogatory of the Jews. That is the Jews' answer to the facts produced in this publication. In scores and hundreds of public libraries, the Jews are using the members of their race who happen to be on library boards, or are using committees of their race to influence library boards to clear the library of all books, pamphlets, and papers that deal with the Jewish question in a manner to leave any doubt that the Jews are paragons of virtue and the chosen people. This is occurring in the United States. It's occurring in some of those Eastern American states that stood most valiantly for the cause of free speech and a free press in other days. Let it go on. Multiply these instances. Add madness to madness. Each act of this nature simply gives a local proof, visible and intelligible to each community where it happens, that what is written about the Jews is true. The present status of the Jewish question is this. A beginning has been made on the too long accumulating facts. Jewish recognition of the truth has been expressed in soberness among the leaders. Jewish action in response has been, for themselves, denial. For others, it's suppression. The result to date is abject failure to meet the case. This was published January 29th, 1921, in, of course, the Dearborn Independent. Okay, that is the first half of today's program. Okay, at the top of the page of this next section, we have an excerpt from a letter. The writer of the following letter is a Jew. He says this, "Gentlemen, because you believe in a good cause," said Dr. Johnson, "is no reason why you should feel called upon to defend it, for by your manner of defense, you may do your cause much harm. The above applying to me, I will only say that I have received the books you sent me and read both with much interest. You are rendering the Jews a very great service, that of saving them from themselves. It takes courage and nerve and intelligence to do and pursue such a work, and I admire you for it." That's the end of the excerpt of that letter from a Jew. It doesn't have a name. All right, this next article is The Jews and the Religious Persecution Cry. We cheerfully give the Jews of the U.S. credit for knowing when they are getting their money's worth. In the defense that has been set up for them, they know that they have not had their money's worth, neither from Jewish money collectors nor from the Gentile fronts to whom the money has been paid. The Lewis Marshall line of defense has broken down. The boycott has dribbled into nothingness. Speeches in Congress and editorials in newspapers have sounded too hollow to carry conviction. The question has proved itself too far or far too big for those who have entered the defense for gain, to satisfy personal grudges, or to win what they feel to be favor of the stronger side. The Jews long ago quit the course which some of the Gentile fronts still continue. The Jews recognized the futility of it. No intelligent Jew in the United States ever was asinine enough to declare that the Jewish question is a religious question, and that the Dearborn Independence investigation of that question constituted religious persecution, quote-unquote. No Jew known beyond the next street has ever ventured such a silly charge. But it's apparently all that remains for the Gentile fronts to shout about. From what can be learned from them, they are for the most part men of no religion themselves, and they use the term religious persecution as a red flag which they think will stir people into action. It's rather curious how the cry of religious persecution is used to evoke the spirit of persecution against these alleged persecutors. The Dearborn Independent this week goes out of its course to squelch, once and for all, this cry of religious persecutions. Three statements are sufficient to outline the situation. First, neither directly nor by implication has the Dearborn Independent held that the Jewish question is a religious question. On the contrary, supported by the highest Jewish authority, this paper has held that the Jewish question is one of race and nationality. Second, there is no religious persecution of the Jew in the U.S., unless the agitation of various humane societies for the abolition of kosher killing may be considered such. The Massachusetts Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals has published a valuable study of the Jewish method of slaughtering animals for food, in which is adduced much scientific evidence to support the conclusion that the Jewish method is needlessly cruel. But even this can only with difficulty be stretched into an interference with the religion of the Jews. The Jewish method of slaughter, as now practiced, is not commanded in the Old Testament, but in the Talmud, and is, therefore, not religious in the authoritative sense, but traditional. Moreover, there is positive evidence that modern methods achieve the Jewish purpose, which is the disposal of the blood of the carcass, much better than does the Jewish method. This is the only instance where even remotely the religion of the Jews has been touched. Third, the fact is that while there is no religious persecution of the Jews, there is very much real religious persecution by the Jews. That's one of the outstanding characteristics of organized Jewish life in the U.S. It's active, unceasing, powerful, and virulent attacks upon any and all forms of Christianity which may chance to come to public notice. Now and again we hear of outbreaks of sectarian bigotry between Catholics and Protestants, but these are not to be compared with the steady, relentless, alert, anti-Christian activity of the Jewish organizations. There are doctrinal disputes within the Christian churches, but none that challenge the basis of Christianity itself. Organized Judaism, however, is not content with doctrinal disputation. But it enlists its vast commercial and political power against everything that it regards as, in its own words, Christological manifestations. Now, folks, these are facts, and being as that they are facts, they're important, and they ought to be publicly known. No president of the United States has yet dared to take his inaugural oath on the open pages of the New Testament, because the Jews would denounce him. When General Pershing announced that he considered the morale of the American soldier due to the interest of the Christian men and women at home, the Jews had cut out the word Christian. Various governors of American states have used the word Christian in their Thanksgiving proclamations, and they've been obliged to excise it on demand of the Jews. The word Christian was compelled to be cut out of the officer's training manual at the Plattsburgh training camp, everything that would remind the child in school that he's living in the midst of a Christian civilization and a nation declared by the Supreme Court to be founded on Christian principles has been ordered out of the public schools upon Jewish demand. People sometimes ask why 3 million Jews can control the affairs of 100 million Americans, in the same way that 10 Jewish students can abolish the mention of Christmas and Easter out of schools containing 3,000 Christian pupils. Well, we let it happen. We allow it. In a nation and at a time when a minority of Jews can print every year a record of apologies they have extorted from public officials for having inadvertently used the term Christian, it's desirable that this charge of religious persecution should be placed where it belongs, in the Daily American Tribune, a Catholic daily published in Dubuque, Iowa, appeared a recent headline which said a great deal. Not persecution of the Jews, but protection of the Christians. It is now proposed to let the Jews speak for themselves on this question. The Jewish press has been searched for an authoritative expression charging that the study of the Jewish question constitutes religious persecution, and none has been found. That cry has been reserved for Gentile fronts for use among Christians. All the attacks from the Jewish camp are against the doctrines and institutions of the Christians. They have carried on an insistent and successful persecution, and the details of it have filled the Jewish press for years past. Upon reading the following sections, the remark of Dean Swift will probably come to mind. Quote, "We are fully convinced that we shall always tolerate them, but that they will not tolerate us." End quote. The Red Cross is objectionable to the Jew. H. Lesauer, in the Jewish Times, proposed that the Megan David be substituted for the Red Cross on the Red Cross Society badges worn by Jews. "We should not let our sensitiveness to charges of intolerance overcome our conscientious religious objections to the cross," says Mr. Lesauer. The editor of the Jewish Independent thinks the suggestion is worthy of serious consideration. The Gideons are objectionable to the Jew. The Gideons is the name given to the Christian Commercial Travelers Association of America, whose efforts are responsible for the Bibles that are to be found in most hotel rooms. This is from the Cleveland Jewish Independent. Quote, "It is quite evident that the Gideons do not know a typically Jewish name when they see or hear one. The Gideons' object, according to their letterheads, is winning commercial traveling men for Christ, and the way this is done is by placing a Christian Bible in each guest room of every hotel. The Gideons have been at it a long time, long enough to know better, but the other day they sent a letter to Max Cohen of this city, who is a traveling man but the kind the Gideons have no right to ask for funds, and the person who selected him for an easy mark certainly should have had better sense. Mr. Cohen utterly failed to fall for the invitation, and instead of sending his little donation, he wrote a letter to the secretary, one C.A. Johnson, in which he bluntly said, 'Don't you think you ought to use better judgment than to ask me to contribute to a strictly religious work opposite to my own belief?' If the Gideons insist upon filling up hotels with Bibles that have no business where they should go to the right persons for contributions. The Jews do not like the Salvation Army, nor the YMCA. Many thousands of printed lines expressed the fury with which they regarded attempts to Christianize the Army and the Navy during the war, and the wild arguments with which they sought to make Y work and Salvation Army work to appear to be a violation of the principle of no union of church and state. The same objection was made to religious welfare work during the building of the Panama Canal. If there's any challenge of this on the part of uninformed Gentile fronts, the Jews themselves will not challenge it, the evidence can be produced. It is only a matter of space. The Jews did not like Theodore Roosevelt's choice of a hymn for the Progressive Party. with Honorable Oscar S. Strauss as the nominee for the governorship of New York on the progressive ticket, this question arises. Will the voters on the east side of New York march to the progressive battle hymn, Onward Christian Soldiers, or will the song have to be changed to fit the candidate? That's from a publication called American Israelite. The Jews hate with a malice beyond expression what they call mission holes. That is, a place of instruction maintained by Christian churches where inquiring Jews may learn what Christianity is, and, in many instances, where destitute and neglected Jews may receive assistance and counsel. The boast of how the Jew cares for his own is a given jolt by the dire need which has called Christian welfare work into Jewish settlements. This hatred overrode good judgment so completely that in 1911, Assemblyman Haman introduced to the New York State Legislature a bill making it an offense punishable by fine or imprisonment to entice or tempt a minor under 16 into a religious mission, Sunday school or church, without the written consent of the parents or guardian of the minor. The language indicates a part of the contempt in which the welfare work undertaken by Christian institutions for the neediest class of children in America is held by the leaders among the Jews, not by the masses of Jews themselves, however, except when they are terrified by the leaders. In St. Louis, application for a charter of the Jewish Christian Association was opposed. The converted Jews wanted an association of their own. They represented that they had been ostracized by the Jews and were desirous of organizing and owning their own meeting place. A referee advised against the charter on the ground that it would be contrary to the broad spirit of religious freedom guaranteed under the Constitution of Missouri. The referee was, of course, coached by Jews. In the name of religious freedom, these Jews opposed giving an association freedom enough to preach the gospel. In Toronto, the Jewish leaders issued a proclamation throughout all Toronto Jewry, that would be, forbidding the use of reading rooms, baths, dispensaries, motion picture shows, or anything else, which they described as the petty bribery of conversionist tricksters who seek for their wealthy donors to open the gates of heaven and find salvation for their sins by converting a weak-minded Jew. By the way, all converted Jews are weak-minded or criminal, if we're to believe the hundreds of statements to that effect in the Jewish papers. The Jews are, without exception, superior people until they become Christians. Then, learn what they are from the Jewish leaders. Let me stop. The handful of Jews that I've known, I mean, one in particular, it did strike me as kind of odd, like his just absolute disdain for Christianity and Jesus Christ. Like, he made a snarky, snide comment about how he didn't believe in it, and it kind of stuck with me over the years, especially learning all this stuff. They really do hate Christianity. They hate Christ. And, of course, some of their comedians and entertainers, like Sarah Silverman, a disgusting kikus, has said, I'm glad the Jews killed Christ. I wish we could do it again, or I'd love to do it again. Something to that effect. They hate Christians. They hate Christianity. I think because they're told all this stuff that we supposedly did or really didn't do to them, and we haven't really done anything to them that should cause them to hate us. We've been nothing but arms wide open towards them in everything. No one has blessed the state of Israel more than American white Christian people have since its inception in, 47 or 48. No other country has blessed the state of Israel like we have. And it says in the scripture, those who bless Israel shall be blessed themselves. If Israel is the true state of the ancient Israelite people, and Jews are true ancient Israelites, and they are true Israel today, what do we have to show for it? We have zero to show for it. We actually have curses placed upon us. Look at how badly our country is suffering. Look at how we've gone downhill since the end of World War II. We bless these people more than anyone else on the earth. What do we have to show for it? They hate Christ, they hate Christians, and they're never going to stop. You can't change it. I think it said in Mark, I think it's the Gospel of Mark, one of the Gospels, maybe it's Matthew. Anyways, the point is, Pontius Pilate took Jesus in front of this large group of Jews when they were accusing him, and they wanted the Romans to kill him because he violated their religious tradition. And the Jews, it says, the Jews cried out, "Let his blood be on us and our children for all time." This is the attitude they have towards Christ and towards Christians. They want to eliminate us. Look at what they did in Bolshevik Russia. Anyways, I'm getting too far off hand here. Let me get back to it. Back to the text here. Among the nice names for this welfare work are Jesus Holes, Mission Traps, Jew Snatchers, Child Stealers. It happened that one of the helpers of the Chicago Gospel Mission was principal of a Chicago public school. The Jews raised a great outcry against him. They denounced him as unfit to teach children and guilty of the moral turpitude of eating food provided by taxes of which a large share is received from Jews whose children they seek to entice from their parental religion and whose men and women they are seeking to degrade into liars and hypocrites. All because a competent man was willing to meet Jewish inquirers or perhaps bring a few of the benefits of civilization into the neglected ghetto. If this school teacher were Christian enough to have a conscience, he would resign, said the Jewish thunderers, and with that never-failing tinge of dark-mindedness they added this: what is done in secret in these haunts can, of course, only be guessed. You want to talk about bigotry? This from a people who encourage the cry that the Dearborn Independent is engaged in religious persecution, though the Dearborn Independent has not yet carried even one of the scores of sensational and important stories which show the federal government discovering synagogues and rabbis as agents of illicit liquor traffic. These haunts, as they call them, and hints of the things that may go on there, is the only way the American Israelite publication can find to refer to welfare works in which some of the best people, from no motive but the goodness of their hearts, engage. You know what? This is kind of off topic, but you know, after a point, I'm tired of seeing Christians go and try to cater to other people, other stranger races. Why do they do this? It's so stupid how they try to go out there and win over Jews or go to the heart of Africa and try to turn, you know, 59 IQ'd tribesmen banging on a tree stump into Christians and giving their life over to Christ. That is pretty annoying. I must say, I'm tired of it myself. Continuing on, a book of about 500 pages could be filled with the unreasonable and, in many cases, positively vicious statements of leading Jews on any of the subjects touched upon here. The Jews do not like the Christian Sabbath. The literature of attack against this institution is voluminous, and the arguments are extreme. Sunday is Christian. Therefore, to the Jew, it's taboo. Court records in every state bear testimony to the fight of the Jews against Sunday. Few legislatures have escaped being pestered with bills on the subject. The latest fight has been the strongest yet waged, to destroy Sunday by throwing it wide open to Jewish exploitation. Yet the Jews are most chary of their own Sabbath. I guess that means protective. When recent college examinations fell on Jewish holy days, the Jews had the examinations changed. When primary elections last year fell on Jewish holidays, every power was moved to change them. There are Jewish records of a Western governor being remonstrated with because a condemned criminal was sentenced to be hanged on Saturday. Did the governor mean to offend 3 million Jews, as they say? The St. Louis Charity Fair in 1908 planned to remain open on Friday evening. A great outcry took place. Did the managers of that fair mean to insult the Jews? Didn't they know the Jewish Sabbath began on Friday night? But when it turns to a question of maintaining the integrity of Christian Sunday, oh, poo-poo, they cry. Don't the Christians know that Sunday perpetuates the silliest superstition? That their God Jesus rose from the dead? When certain people aid the post office employees in an attempt to close the post offices on Sunday, the Jews regard it as a step back towards the Dark Ages. Here's a Jewish editorial relating to Governor Cox. It appears that Governor Cox, in 1914, stood for a decent Sunday and liquor law enforcement, and this is the threat held out to him. At the 59th Jackson Day Banquet of Wayne County, Ohio Democracy, which was held at Worcester, Governor Cox made the principal address in which he defended laws passed at his instigation. The governor laid particular stress on the fact that for the first time in her history, Ohio now enjoys a Christian Sabbath. "I stand or fall by the Christian Sabbath in the next campaign," the governor is reported to have said. There are many who construe the declaration to mean that Governor Cox has bid defiance to the liberal element of the state and will rely upon the religious and class prejudices which he's arousing and keeping alive in the rural districts to re-elect him to his present office or, what is clearly plain from his entire attitude, boost him into the nomination of United States senatorship. The American Israelite publication will take a great pleasure about the time the leaves begin to turn in reminding Governor Cox of his statement that he will stand or fall by a Christian Sabbath in the coming campaign. The literature of Jewish thought towards Sunday presents a complete evidence of the leader's antagonism to this distinctly Christian and Anglo-Saxon institution. Sunday has never been regarded as set apart in those countries where the Jewish idea has most infiltrated. The decline of Sunday in the United States is directly along the line of those invasions of the Sunday spirit, which are mostly aligned with a Jewish commercial interest. In Great Britain and her colonies, where the Jew is not permitted to usurp a superior place as chief censor of morals and religion and education, Sunday is decently observed. The situation in this country is that, instead of enjoying its liberty, the Jewish leaders have taken liberties. The student who wishes to know how deep and hard-set is the anti-Sunday program will find all the material he wants in Jewish sources. The theme of this article is religious prejudice. You will not find it anywhere within the whole range of the Jewish question, except on the Jewish side. There is, in the U.S., a religious prejudice, but it is strictly Yiddish. If the Christian population bothered 1/100,000th part as much about Jewish religion as the Jews bother about Christian observances, the whole fabric of Talmudic teaching would be consumed in the bright light to which general attention would bring it, the bright light from which it has always been concealed. Sheer analysis in the interest of mental health, if undertaken by 50 men, would compel the Jewish people by their own decision to abandon the darkness which holds them now. Jewish Talmudism owes its existence today to the indifference with which it is regarded. This is the far opposite extreme of religious persecution. The list of headlines describing the various angles of Jewish anti-Christian religious prejudice is not, however, exhausted. The Jew is prejudiced against the Bible. When he uses that term, he does not mean what the ordinary person means. Therefore, he does what he can to destroy public honor of the book, unless it be an occasion where a president has been inaugurated, when it will run through the Jewish press like a strong breeze that once more has a Christian statesman ignored the Bible and turned to the Jewish Bible. It is rather a trifling matter to mention. its significance comes solely from the light it throws on the Jewish attitude. It's not a trifling thing in Jewry, as the country will probably be made aware if any future president should be sworn in with, say, the Sermon on the Mount open before him. And yet, even here, we observe a strange paradox. A Jewish authority says, "The Jew is a paradox. He is at once an idealist and a materialist. He is parsimonious and extravagant. He is courageous and cowardly. He is modest and vulgar. He is persistent and yielding. He is peaceful and warlike." And so on and so on. And though the Jew opposes the Bible in the schools, he never misses a chance to put it there with the Jewish trademark. He quotes Psalms. "We wrote them." He quotes Isaiah. "We Jews did that." Most people sit open-mouthed at these glorious authors of Scripture and do not know how to answer. It is time the churches began to learn what to say to the Jewish taunts, that "we gave you your God, we gave you your Bible, Jesus was a Jew, we gave you Jesus." Perhaps it's also time that the Jews themselves consider how long the boast will stand the usage they are giving it. In any case, the literature which the Jews wrongfully claim is their own production is rather far distant in time to justify its being used as a mantle of glory for the political rabbis, the discredited theatrical and movie magnates, the violent penmen of the Jewish press. Rather too distant in time. We, the race that confronts the Jews, have done somewhat more recent work. For example, the Declaration of Independence and the Emancipation Proclamation, not to mention the psalms and pronouncements of great American prophets that have lifted up the world. So, the Jew is very willing that the Bible should be in the public schools, provided it is not what he calls the Christian Bible. Listen to this. "Hebrew is to be taught in the Chicago high schools. Students who include this language in their course are to receive the credit now allowed for the study of other classical languages. Of infinite value in the training of the mind are the wonderful narratives of Genesis. Boys and girls will find the history of Israel under the Judges much more appealing than Caesar's bridge over the Rhine." The people of New Jersey thought so too. They believed that a reading from this ancient book every day would mean much to the general culture of the pupils. But what did the paper just quoted say about it? It called the cultivated Bible appreciators of New Jersey soul-snatching enthusiasts, and raised a mighty yell about the forcible conversion of Jewish children, although it was provided that Jewish or any other children should be excused from the reading if desired. Another mighty yell about excusing the children on account of the tyranny of reading the Christian Bible in the schools, regardless of the fact, which every school teacher knows, that no class of children is oftener out of school for religious reasons than are the Jews. Truly, these people, the Jews, are a paradox. They are not fair. They are constituted so that they cannot see the other side of anything. For a time, they actually do convince the secularists that everything public should be secularized down to the last notch of atheistic demand. Non-Jews are fair. They're willing to see the other people's point of view. When it was said to us that the immersion of Venice was a cruelty upon Jewish school pupils, we said, without investigation, "Out goes the merchant then, fine, get rid of it." We discovered later that the Jewish children liked and appreciated the play better than any other group. Brander Matthews helped us discover that. And so, when they said, "Reading the Bible is sheer proselytizing, it isn't fair," the non-Jew, who wanted to prove that he was fair and unprejudiced above all things else, a weakness which the Jews know how to manipulate. And then the non-Jew said, "Well, then, fine, out goes the Bible, too." And went out it did go. Very well, what's next? "You must observe Good Friday." In other words, to please the sensitive Jewish natures, we must eradicate from Christian civilization all that is Christian in it. In the meantime, what transpires? having induced fair-minded non-Jews to do all these things, and every one above enumerated has been done over and over again at Jewish demand, the Jews then proceeded to sow Judaism on the fields thus denuded of Christianity. No religion in the institutions of the state. Yet in every state university last year there were, and in every state university this year there probably will be, courses of lecture delivered by Jewish rabbis, the lectures delivered in the colleges themselves, propagandizing the youth of the non-Jews with a Judaistic religion, Judaistic ethics, and economics. This is what the so-called Jewish program exists for. It's not a Jewish program. It is Jewish propaganda in public educational institutions. That is the repayment the Jews have made for our fair-mindedness. That's right. We play by the rules and they don't. How's that? Their demand for complete secularization is merely their preparation of the soil for their carefully organized sowing of the seed of Judaism, and non-Jews permit it to continue, for there is nothing they fear so much as that their opposition will be regarded as religious prejudice. The Jew glories in religious prejudice, as the American glories in patriotism. Religious prejudice is the Jew's chief expression of their own true patriotism. It is the only well-organized, active, and successful form of religious prejudice in the country, because they have succeeded in pulling off the gigantic trick of making not their own attitude, but any opposition to it, bear the stigma of prejudice and persecution. That is why the Jew uses these terms so frequently. He wants to label the other fellow first. That is why any investigation of the Jewish question is so quickly advertised as anti-Semitism. The Jew knows the advantage of labeling the other man. Wrong labels are most useful. This does not by any means exhaust the list of headlines describing the various avenues in which the expression of virulent Jewish religious prejudice and persecution is found, but it exhausts the space allotted to these articles each week. Therefore, the subject will be concluded next week. It's not a pleasant subject. Religious prejudice is just as unpleasant to write about as it is to experience in any other way. It is totally contrary to the genius of the American and the Anglo-Saxon. We have always regarded religion as a matter of conscience. To believe as he will is part of every man's fundamental liberty. To interfere with force to change anyone's belief is exceedingly stupid. Holding these hereditary principles, one chooses to study that active stream of influence in American life which is known as the Jewish stream, and immediately upon doing so, one finds himself classed with the bigots and torturers of other times. It is now time to show that the cry of "Bigot!" is raised mostly by bigots. There is a religious prejudice in this country. There is, indeed, a religious persecution. There is a forcible shoving aside of the religious liberties of a majority of the people. And this prejudice and persecution and use of force is Jewish and nothing but Jewish. This is the answer to the cry of religious persecution, and we shall make it so complete and definite that a repetition of the cry against students of the Jewish question will automatically mark the criers as either too ignorant or too vicious for consideration. That's the end of this article, which concludes our time here today. This was issued on June 4th, 1921. In, of course, the Dearborn Independent. I hope you guys have enjoyed today's episode. We are, just so you know, we are about halfway through. Believe it or not. So, there you have it. Religious persecution. It's a stick that the Jews use to pretty much erase any host country's connection to a native religion, a native culture, a native ethos. And then, of course, once they strip away the native ethos, they substitute Jewish ethos in there. And this is how effectively they work. They can be the smallest minority in the country, but they have enough power, influence, and intimidation to where they can get their way. Let me just say that reading this brings up a point that I think needs to be made. It needs to be pointed out so that people realize this in the future. If anything is to be done, if the tide is to be turned, the biggest mistake that Christians have made is being too weak-kneed, too backbending, too charitable, too accepting, too tolerant, too inclusive. No good deed goes unpunished, especially no good deed toward your enemy, toward the Jew who will abuse you and manipulate you for their own ends. And this is the biggest weakness of white people in general, white Christians in particular. They are sadomasochists. They love, and trust me, I say this, I know it full well, growing up with this, they have this belief that, you know, suffering and being a doormat here will assure them a reward in heaven. And God bless them, they're good-hearted. You got to stop believing this. It's harming our people, our nation, our country more than you will ever know. This is not healthy, to be so accommodating, to be so inclusive, to give up everything you have to others. It is not healthy. Pathological altruism will be the extinction of the white man on this planet. I'm pretty well convinced of it. And for too long, whites, white Christians in particular, have had an attitude of go along to get along. Peace with others and peaceful, neutral means is the goal. Yet all our enemies, be they Jews or Muslims or even blacks that want to conquer and destroy us, they want victory and conquering and taking over of us, whereas we just want to get along. When you have two forces at play where one just wants to get along and doesn't really want to win or defend itself, I don't like those odds. And unfortunately, we are where we are today because we've had this lazy, stupid attitude. And quite honestly, it needs to change. Our Christian God does not want us to be a doormat, does not want us to be a slave. We were not born with saddles upon our backs. I hope you all have a Merry Christmas. Be safe out there. Be safe in your travels. Until next time, guys, I want to thank Sven, RadioArian.com. Thank you to all the listeners. Thank you for all the supporters who get on YouTube and post your comments and your support. I try to read most all of them. God bless you all. God bless you all, excuse me. And until next time, guys, thank you. Take care. God bless. Bye-bye.
You're tuned in to Radio Arian.